From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we remember the thousands of Michiganders lost to COVID-19.
To see people grieve in isolation, to me, was perhaps the most difficult part.
One funeral director talks about a year spent helping so many families say goodbye. Then more states move to end the tampon tax. Can Michigan be next?
The pandemic has really just exacerbated this problem that people are calling period poverty, meaning, you know, access to products.
And how free water testing in Flint is helping rebuild community trust.
Unfortunately, not knowing what's in their water, it's like they were left behind. And that's the goal of this lab, is no one is left behind and no one is dealing with this alone.
We'll meet some staff from the Flint Community Water Lab. All that and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On this one-year anniversary of Michigan's first reported cases of COVID-19, it's natural to reflect on how our individual lives have changed. Perhaps what's harder, what feels less natural, is to think about the great human toll of the pandemic. More than 500,000 lives lost in the United States to date. In Michigan, we lost nearly 17,000 people. It's a dark high watermark. This was Michigan's deadliest year on record. The number of deaths overall, not just COVID, up 18% over the previous year. We wanted to spend some time putting into context the process of mourning that had to be repeated thousands of times, saying goodbye to loved ones lost to something as inexplicable as a fast-moving global pandemic. Joining us now is Patty Lynch, funeral director at Lynch & Sons Funeral Home in Clawson. Patty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What's the past year been like for the funeral home?
You know, it's been obviously at times sad and stressful. There's also been strangely beautiful moments as people have tried to process this with as much grace and hope as one can muster in such a terrible situation. It's a little bit mysterious for me, because in some ways I recognize the profound nature of the past year in comparison to many other years. And yet at the same time, you know, since I was a little boy, I can remember being around dead bodies quite often. And so, you know, it's, for us, I think it was a major challenge in many ways. And yet at the same time, we're accustomed to getting the dead where they need to go, whether it's into the grave or into the fire or wherever it may be. A year ago, the spring of 2020, April and May and so forth, when the death rate was really spiking, that was really a lot to process, because at that point, funerals as we know it weren't even really happening. It was really about efficiency. And it was about getting people buried and cremated as quickly as possible. And I came home every night and I think drank nearly a bottle of wine every night.
Yeah.
Just kind of getting through it, you know, was the task. And then since then we've seen a return to, you know, some normalcy. There are still, you know, challenges, but we're definitely experiencing much more normalcy than we were a year ago.
I have a logistical question.
Sure.
How have you been helping people figure out mourning at a time when, you know, the physical comforts of other people are just not possible and smaller gatherings are an absolute necessity?
Well, you know, there's an old cliche that joy shared is joy increased and grief shared is grief diminished. And there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, we process our sadness, you know, with each other historically as human beings. And so to see people grieve in isolation, to me was perhaps the most difficult part. As I mentioned, you know, whether it sounds callous or not, I don't know, but I'm accustomed to death, obviously. But I was not accustomed to seeing people have to grieve alone. And, you know, seeing a husband or wife of, you know, 60 years die and the spouse have to, you know, quarantine for a couple weeks, you know, that to me was insult to injury. since then, we, you know, we've been able to manage getting people in to pay their respects, to offer their sympathies, keeping the numbers down by allowing people to come and go. And that's been incredibly cathartic, I think. I mean, it's amazing. We obviously, as funeral directors, believe in funerals, and we're one of the first cultures in the history of the world for whom funerals have become optional. You know, it's striking the number of people that just don't have them anymore. The body gets cremated and that's the end of it.
Wow. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, over half the population is cremated. Now, a lot of those people have traditional services first, or at least have visitations or wakes or something, and then the body's cremated. But for so many people, they've associated over the last 20, 30 years cremation with immediate cremation and nothing beyond that. And, you know, that just simply wasn't possible for other cultures, because they were so intimately connected to the dead. They actually had to get the dead out of the house and into the grave or into the fire themselves. They might have an undertaker to, you know, provide the casket and assist a little bit, but this was essentially a community task. And so now, you know, we've figured out ways to outsource this type of thing to individuals like me. And I think that we're the lesser for it. If nothing else, I think COVID has shown a lot of people just how valuable and meaningful and ultimately cathartic funerals are, and our need for one another, especially when, you know, we're facing, you know, sort of these existential mysteries. And so I'm hoping that the silver lining is that people will recognize more than ever the beauty and necessity of funerals and what they mean for a society.
Patty, I kind of assumed when we started this conversation that you would have dealt with a lot of deaths of people who died because of COVID, but obviously that can vary a lot geographically around Michigan. Have you had a lot of families whose loved ones died from COVID?
Yeah, the number has definitely decreased. We had our fair share. As I mentioned, about a year ago, that's when we really saw, like, for example, the location that I operate here in Clawson. As a family, we operate 7 locations, but I'm here, you know, pretty much every day. You know, we saw the number of deaths nearly double over the course of about 6 weeks, 2 months. And most of that was due to COVID. But after that first few months, we definitely saw a decline into the summer. And then the fall, there was a little bit of an uptick, but nothing outrageous. So we dealt with it. We did not deal with it like some of, you know, our Black colleagues in the city were just overwhelmed. In fact, we went and ended up handling some deaths out of Detroit and Highland Park that we otherwise would not have probably handled. But some of the locations down there were just totally and completely overwhelmed. I mean, I heard stories that there were funeral homes that had over 100 bodies in their building at one time, which is just unthinkable. I think for us, the most we had in the building at one time was maybe 15, which is a lot. You know, normally we might have 4 or 5. So for us, it wasn't logistically that overwhelming. It was emotionally devastating, especially seeing these families, as I mentioned, you know, grieve alone and in isolation and not be able to connect with their normal, you know, religious institutions and rituals and that sort of thing. You know, for us, the COVID deaths have definitely decreased as the year went on, for sure.
Patty, I feel like people in your line of work tend to see humanity through a sort of magnifying glass. You know, we meet you in such intense times of our lives. I imagine that that's part of what draws people to the work in different moments. But did this year give you, did it show you anything you didn't know about grieving or about how people are with their families and their loved ones?
That's a great question, and probably one that I could answer more articulately if I really reflected upon it. I mean, my uncle, the writer Thomas Lynch, funeral director, has talked about how being a funeral director in many ways is just having really, really intimate access to people's stories. And I think it's one of the reasons why his writing has been so good for so long. Just the access that he was given over so many decades. I don't know if I learned anything new. I think what I maybe already knew has been reaffirmed, and that is that we need one another to make sense of the suffering that we all ultimately experience. And I think too that the dead are more meaningful than we as a culture at large oftentimes, you know, want them to be. I think that it's sometimes easier for us to dismiss them because they're no longer of use to us. But the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, how we handle the dead will always correlate to the way in which we handle the most vulnerable among us. You know, whether it's the sick, the mentally ill, children, the elderly, the refugee, the way in which we handle the dead, how tenderly we move them from one place to the next, the meaning that we attach to those movements, there's a correlation, I believe, to our other relationships. I think one of the sort of strangest but most beautiful analogies that my uncle ever made, he was trying to sort of refute this idea that a dead body is just a shell, which is something that people like to say. And he said, you know, that's not really the case. We're embodied people. He said, if anything, I would compare dead bodies to newborn babies. They're vulnerable and they represent a new reality. And, you know, when in doubt, treat them as gently as possible. And so I hope anyway that our relationship to the dead is maybe reimagined a bit because of this experience.
Patty Lynch is a funeral director with Lynch and Sons in Clawson. Patty, thank you so much for talking to us, and thanks for your work this year.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
The city of Flint has a new nonprofit water lab that's trying to restore some of the public trust lost during the water crisis. We'll meet some of its staff in just a minute. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Next month marks the 7th anniversary of Flint switching its municipal water source to the polluted Flint River. The decision was made by an unelected emergency manager appointed by then-Governor Rick Snyder. Besides the mammoth health implications for everyone in Flint, another one of the big losses was public trust. This past October, a step was taken to start to restore that trust. That's the creation of the Flint Water Lab. Joining us now to fill in the details are Dominique Strong, Community Outreach Coordinator at the lab. Welcome to Stateside, Dominique.
Thanks for having me, April.
Thank you. And we're also joined by the principal chemist at the lab, Alexandria Shapansky. Alexandria, hi there.
Thanks for having us.
Dominique, people say the Flint Water Lab or the Flint Community Lab, but can you tell us the lab's official name?
The lab official name is Mackenzie Patrice Crone Memorial, and it is the Flint Community Laboratory. And we go by FCL, Flint Community Lab.
Why was Mackenzie Crone's name chosen for this?
Well, Mackenzie was a baby that unfortunately she developed health issues from the switch from the water to the Flint River. And due to those complications, Mackenzie, she lost her life to the decisions, you know, from the unelected emergency manager, as you stated. And in memory of her, just to so no one can forget about this water crisis, the Flint Community Lab was named in her honor for her memorial.
That feels important. I mean, we often say the people of Flint, the people of Flint living with this, the people of Flint surviving that. But putting her name to it It feels different.
Yes, yes, it does. And it feels different in a way of, unfortunately, that's the way that the baby, you know, lost her life. But in a solution, if we turn it to a positive realm, it's a solution-driven entity, you know, due to the unfortunate of the decisions of the unelected officials, you know, that decided that the Flint River was a way to provide water to Flint residents. So yeah. The Flint Community Lab, we are here as a solution as far as how that would look, what it looks like, and who is for.
Dominique, will you tell us a little bit about your experience of the water crisis when it first hit 7 years ago?
My experience with the Flint water crisis was, it was quite a journey. I remember getting on a bus the day that Rick Snyder had addressed the state, and it was a group of us. We chartered a bus to Lansing to do a silent protest. And just being in that atmosphere as far as why we were there, it was just so surreal. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that we are at the Capitol advocating for clean water, you know? And it's been one heck of a journey because one minute we are in the news and everyone's talking about it, and then the next, you know, no one makes reference to it or anything as if it didn't exist or as if it doesn't exist, I'll say. Mm-hmm. So my journey with the Flint water crisis has been one. But yesterday was my 1 year anniversary in this position. And it is a rewarding position to be in because 7 years ago, I was in Lansing advocating for clean water, you know, and affordable water. And now here I am 7 years later in a position where I am going into the community with the students to be citizen science with providing water testing kits to bring back to the lab for Alex to analyze and process, you know, so we could give test results back to the Flint residents just so they could know what's coming out of their faucet. So that's been my journey with the Flint water crisis as a Flint native.
Yeah. Alex, can you tell us a little bit about the state of Flint's water today? What's the range of conditions in the water that you've tested?
Yeah, and that's precisely the point, is there's not a consistent range of results coming back. You look in some areas of Flint, and if you look at the map of the pipelines, you see the areas are green and everything's okay. And then you see areas where they don't even know the condition of the water, which is primarily where the center and the lab is located. And so that's the unfortunate thing, is you see a lot of poor zip codes in the region of Flint, just unfortunately not knowing what's in their water. It's like they were left behind. And that's really the goal of this lab, is no one is left behind and no one is dealing with this alone. So yeah, unfortunately, we are seeing some ranges that vary depending on where they are. And thankfully, we are seeing some lower levels of lead in the water. And this could be due to a variety of conditions, more specifically the pipes being replaced. We're still on the search for some higher levels so that we can get those fixed and filters can be applied and we can make sure everyone's happy and healthy.
Are there remedies that you can suggest for folks when you, say, find lead or X or Y or Z compound in there? Is it just the test result, or do you have things that you can tell them about what's in their water?
Yeah, so Dominique can actually speak a little more on that, but I know that we definitely supply filters and education on how to change and maintain those filters.
Dominique, what about that? What do you tell people who find that their water is still not quite safe to drink?
Well, we recommend them to flush it, you know, first thing in the morning. Don't just jump up and utilize your water, you know, let it run at least for 5 minutes, you know, because the water has been sitting for at least 6 hours. So you want to at least let it flush itself first before utilizing it through a filter. Because we still have to use the filters here in Flint. We cannot utilize the water without the filters unless you have a whole home filtration system in your home. We also encourage the residents to seek out health services such as Genesee Health System, because they provide bone testings along with blood testing as well in the bloodstream. So as far as remedies, I wouldn't call them remedies, April. They're kind of like a process, a procedure. You know, you have to let your water run for 5 minutes first through the filter.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can't run hot water through your filter, because if you run hot water through the whole filter, it would damage it. So to be quite honest, April, I wouldn't say it's a remedy. It's really a process that you have to do while living in Flint. And then, you know, with brushing our teeth, we have to use bottled water, you know, if for those that don't trust the water coming through the filter, because not everyone have had their pipes replaced yet. But as of right now, as of December 25th, 2020, 16,838 copper service lines have been replaced. 9,912 full pipe replacements have taken place so far. So, you know, it really depends on how the resident is operating their household, as far as if they have a whole filter system on their home or not, or just utilizing those filters that we provide.
How busy is the lab right now?
Well, the lab is facing so many, there's so many samples coming in from so many residents that want to know it's in their water, and they finally have someone to trust. So it's pretty busy. We have a lot of samples coming in.
Good. If you're just joining us, my guests are staffers with the Flint Community Lab. Alexandria Shapansky is principal chemist. We're also speaking with Dominique Strong, community outreach coordinator. Dominique, was it hard to reestablish that trust? Is it difficult for people to look at anyone who says, I'm here to help with the water, and just say, yeah, okay, here's what's going on?
Well, fortunately, April, the Flint residents, they are happy to see the Flint Community Lab and the services that we have to provide to the Flint community. They are accepting us with open arms. They're willingly, you know, wanting to know what's coming out of their water. You know, 7 years into this, and to actually see a nonprofit that's on the ground working in the community, with the community, for the community, it has been smooth sailing, you know, despite COVID-19, you know, coming and causing a eruption, you know, to everything, to everyone's lives. But besides that, the weather is breaking, and we are just excited as far as what's to come, as far as the residents utilizing the services here at the Flint Community Lab. And April, is not just for Flint residents, it's for surrounding areas as well, and it's for Flint businesses as well. We're here to serve as a trust entity. We are for the community, in the community, by the community. So we are just looking forward to what 2021 has to offer the Flint residents here through the Flint Community Lab.
When the lab first started operations, were you answering a lot of questions about who's funding this or where is this information going? While we're on the subject, maybe we should have you say who's funding this and where the information is going.
The Flint residents, like I said, April, they were they're excited that we are here as a trust entity, as I stated. And some of our funders that we have the Ruth Mott, Charles Stewart Mott, we have Joyce Myers Foundation, Thermal Fisher. Nalgene provided our fill blank water testing bottles that comes with the kits, because we have 3 bottles in our kits. And Nalgene, they actually funded, you know, those water testing bottles. So we have funders from locally, statewide, nationally, that just believes in this vision and this idea that Michael Harris and Shelley Sparks, Jill Ryan from Freshwater Future, you know, they believed in their mission and vision, and here we are. And we are actually up and operating within their vision. So I think with that, for the Flint residents, and also with the Flint residents seeing local familiar faces and hearing familiar names, it makes them feel comfortable to believe that we're here as a solution for the Flint community. And it just makes them come, you know, just to utilize our service here at the water testing lab.
Right.
And also, April, to really strengthen that trust, we have Flint youth that goes into the community and do the community outreach, that's passing out the door hangers, providing the filter education to the residents for those that do feel comfortable with letting us into their home, with coming in with COVID-19 precautions. So with that, you know, that really makes the Flint residents feel like, oh, this is awesome. They have even youth interning in the lab. You know, they go through the process, and Alex could speak to that as far as the process that the students are able to experience while working in the Flint Community Lab.
Tell us more, Alex. Who are the interns?
Oh, yeah. So speaking more on the interns, but then also real quick, speaking on the founders, there are actually four major companies and foundations that really helped us out. We have the Cedar Tree, CS Mott, Community Foundation, and then also the Joyce Foundation. They were really instrumental on getting this lab up and running. And then also, just a fun fact, our mural has every single foundation that's really helped us out. And it was just a personal touch because, again, these are Flint foundations, and that they reached out and they made sure that this lab happened. And so they're actually all attached on our mural, and it's actually a really interesting piece of art to showcase the lab as you walk in.
What kind of tasks do you have the interns doing?
Yeah, so the interns do everything from as soon as the samples come into the lab to running it on our ICP-MS instrument, because I don't really want them babied as they are in this internship. They want to work in this lab, and I'm going to work them. So they do everything from adding nitric acid to our samples to measuring the pH, their turbidity, and then running it through, like I said, our ICP-MS instrument. And it's really instrumental to have these high school and college students work together, because the high school students can learn more about going to college. If that wasn't really in their game plan, maybe now it is. Also working in a lab. As a high school student, I would have loved to work in a lab like this. And it's really nice to just introduce those thoughts and ideas into such young minds.
Mm-hmm. Could each of you maybe tell us about some of the people you've met since the lab's work got started? People who came to get their water tested?
Well, I have met a handful of Flint residents. And the Flint residents, just when they come in, they're smiling. And they're like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe we have something like this here for us to come to find out what's in our water for free. They're just eager, you know, to get the kit, and they bring the kit back within a week. You know, they don't keep the kit out too long, but they are very eager. They're excited about this program, especially when they see the youth working in the lab, because how the lab is set up is a glass window where you can look through, and the students are in there, you know, working hard. And once they see that, it just brings a smile to their face.
Could I just ask, Dominique, when you think about restoring people's trust in their water, like you say, it's not so much one remedy, but this process that people are living with every day to be able to use water for washing, to be able, if they feel comfortable, to use the water for drinking with the filters that are necessary. Are there things that you feel like the lab does for people beyond, you know, telling them the technical things of how their water can be used?
The lab, you know, is just, it's tested by Flint residents for Flint residents to build trust. You know, we staff with the lab of students funded by stipends and providing access to essential training and just educational STEM skills, you know, and it's just providing a continuum of services of education, life skills, and driven as far as what a solution looks like for the Flint water crisis. You know, April, yes, we have residents that do not feel comfortable utilizing the water through the filter. You know, and there are some households that cannot afford a whole filtration system on their home. So, you know, they have to resort to bottled waters as far as everyday living. But with the Flint Community Lab, our goal is just to be solution oriented. We're looking into healthy living as far as eating the right vegetables, you know, to combat the lead found in our bloodstreams. You know, we're just here as a solution entity, and that's what we plan to be moving forward.
My guests today have been Dominique Strong, Community Outreach Coordinator at the Flint Community Lab, and we've also been talking with Alexandria Shapansky. She's the principal chemist at the lab. Dominique, Alexandria, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you, April. Thank you for reaching out to us and just getting the word out about the Flint Community Lab and letting the Flint residents know that we are here to serve them. Also, for further information about the Flint Community Lab, please visit the Flint Development Center website at flintdc.org.
Alexandria, good to talk to you too.
Yeah, thank you for having us, April.
Coming up, some Michigan residents who are fighting the state's tax on feminine hygiene products.
Tampons are not a luxury item in any way. You know, it's a necessity.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you're a person with a period, odds are you know that feeling. You're going about your day, and suddenly, urgently, you realize it's that time of the month. And on top of that, you don't have what you need to get through the day, whether it's a pad or a tampon, a cup, or a pack of Midol. Now imagine you're unprepared, not because you weren't paying attention to the calendar, but because you just can't afford supplies. This one thing, specific to your biological makeup, may be causing you to miss school or work, grocery shopping, or other essential activities that support your basic human needs. Today's guests are part of a movement to end what's commonly referred to as the tampon tax, Michigan's tax on some of the most common hygiene products that people with periods need just to leave the house during that part of their menstrual cycle. After 5 years of introducing bills through Michigan's House and Senate, they're part of a class action lawsuit against the tampon tax in our state. Claire Pfeiffer is one of the three plaintiffs in the civil suit. She's also a volunteer with I Support the Girls Detroit. Claire, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're also talking today with Laura Strausfeld, the co-founder of Period Equity and co-counsel on the Michigan lawsuit. Laura, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure. Thanks.
Claire, will you tell us a little bit how and why you first got involved on this?
I've been volunteering now for a few years with I Support the Girls Detroit, and it's an organization. We collect tampons, pads, other period necessities, and get them to people in need across. Our focus is Southeast Michigan. And through that work, I've seen and heard stories about women who just simply cannot afford this basic necessity. And the more stories and heartbreaking many of them are that you hear, you know, the more you realize there is inequality for women. And it's also just about women's dignity and their health. I mean, this is a basic health necessity. It's, you know, tampons are not a luxury item in any way. You know, it's a necessity. So the more stories I heard and the more I got involved, when, you know, the opportunity came to use our voice this way to help remove this tax for women in Michigan, it felt like the right thing to do.
Those of us with periods have been paying this tax for as long as I can remember, for as long as most of us can remember. Laura, what was the tipping point for you? When was the moment you thought that something needed to change?
Well, it was a long time ago, I will confess. I was a law student. I had just moved to New York City, and probably because I had, you know, too little change in my pocket, I did notice that when I bought a box of tampons and some chapstick, that I was paying tax on the tampons and not the chapstick. And I remember the clerk saying to me, well, the chapstick has a medical use. So I went back to, yes, very funny indeed. And I went to look that up as a law student and realized immediately that this is not only unfair, but it's illegal, it's unconstitutional, it's sex-based discrimination. So I did try for years to interest a law firm in working with me to file a case against New York State, and then watched bills in New York State, you know, get introduced and go nowhere. And then finally in 2016, I found my partner, my now Period Equity partner, Jennifer Weiss-Wolf. And she was doing what I realized needed to be done years ago, and really drawing a lot of attention, public attention through media and talks to this issue. So that was a longer answer to your question. But, you know, I guess the tipping point for me was probably earlier than most people. But it does seem that as soon as people learn about the tampon tax, you know, that's the tipping point.
Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to get caught off guard. And sometimes there are other options, like asking women around us if they have something, or having a backup stash. But there are plenty of women for whom this is a consistent problem. They cannot afford it. Claire, what do you hear from some of the people that you work with about not having the products they need? What does this look like for an adult or a young person, either who's, you know, dealing with cash issues or might even be living unhoused?
So we, through I Support the Girls, have worked with more than 60 organizations, including schools, foster care facilities, program like Vista Maria, which helps women, you know, young women who are transitioning out of foster care. We work with homeless shelters to give them period supplies. And we've heard of young girls who won't go to school because they've got their period and they don't have the products they need at home, or the school, you know, nurses don't have enough to hand out. Which, you know, then puts young women in a position where they're not getting the full education they should have. You know, if they're missing mm-hmm. school to stay home for a period, that's, you know, that to me is an extra inequality, you know, on top of something that's, you know, already feel like they've lost some dignity in that situation. And getting your first period is already scary enough. Imagine doing that in a situation where you didn't have the right supplies and having to go to school. I mean, it just mounts and mounts. So we start thinking about, you know, the shame and the feelings that go with that. And then, you know, as far as homeless women, I mean, we've talked to shelters and heard stories about, you know, if you don't have the supplies, you might find yourself using, you know, what you can get your hands on. I mean, as bad as a wadded up sock, you know, which is also then it talks about, you know, you think about dignity and losing your sense of dignity in that situation. So, and we hear about women who are facing poverty issues, who would rather spend the money on groceries or feeding their kids than, you know, for a box of tampons. Which add up, you know, they're not the most expensive thing you're going to buy, but month after month, it is something that, you know, we know they're not the least expensive. So, you know, those are the kinds of situations that, you know, we feel like we're trying to work with I Support the Girls to alleviate, but we know that there is an economic impact on women that, frankly, people without uteruses don't face.
Laura, tell us about the civil suit.
Well, and I was, I wanted to add to Claire too, that the civil suit to challenge the constitutionality of Michigan's tampon tax came at a time when all of the issues Claire has mentioned have gotten even worse. The pandemic has really just exacerbated this problem that people are calling period poverty, meaning, you know, access to products. So the lawsuit is focused on removing the tampon tax, but you know, the tampon tax is just part of this larger issue of this deep unfairness. And you know, this is a problem, meaning access to menstrual products it also disproportionately affects women of color. So it is an issue around poverty. The tax itself, though, is you know, violates the U.S. and Michigan Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, because it's, you know, a tax that targets a bodily function associated with women. And, you know, even Governor Whitmer has said that the state should stop taxing women for being women, which is, you know, exactly what this tax is.
Well, exactly what products would be tax exempt in the suit?
The focus of the suit is, and this is very common because there is a uniform language around the country where these products, meaning pads, liners, tampons, are grouped together. So that those are the products that we're arguing should be tax exempt.
Why only these items and not, say, period underwear or MyDoll or heating pads?
Excellent question. And, you know, there's no great answer other than that, you know, we're focusing on sales tax law and categories and constitutional arguments. But, you know, and for period underwear is considered clothing. But we're working on that one step at a time. We're focusing first on pads, tampons, liners, et cetera. But certainly those should be tax exempt as well.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Claire Pfeiffer and Laura Strausfeld. Claire is a plaintiff in the civil suit challenging Michigan's tampon tax, and Laura is the co-founder of Period Equity and a co-counsel on that lawsuit. Claire, what do you make of the current situation in Michigan? There's your suit. There's a bill being introduced in the legislature to try to deal with this. And Governor Whitmer has made an accounting in her most recent budget proposal to make whole the lost taxes. Basically, she kind of signaled that she thinks this is going to be changing soon. Where do you see this going? Are we on the cusp of some real change?
I think that it's definitely a very hopeful time. I know we have representatives in the state legislature who are also, you know, behind this, and we've had bipartisan support in the past, which fizzled out and didn't go anywhere. But I think, you know, as Laura mentioned, with the pandemic and the knowledge that women have been disproportionately affected in their pocketbooks by the pandemic, this seems to me a great time for the state to make this change. It seems like we are really well poised. I know that from my circle and my social networking circle that when I've posted about it on Facebook, overwhelmingly, I hear women and men say, yes, this is about time. I can't believe we still have this tax. So I feel, and I'm really like surprised almost by the, you know, I'm like, wow, this is really, you know, I'm glad there is so much support for it. And I think any of our politicians would find that their constituents would be happy to see this tax removed. So I'm hopeful, very hopeful that this will result in some change and, you know, some attention to the issue.
Laura, do you have a sense of why bills that were introduced on this subject in the Michigan House did not get approval in the past?
There are 30 states that still tax tampons around the country. And what started, meaning this practice of taxing medical necessities for women, the American Medical Association has deemed these medical necessities. And, you know, we know, especially from the pandemic, what products are actually essential and that we can't live without. But what's happened is that, you know, what maybe what we'd call an accidental injustice, you know, that the sales tax laws were passed when the majority of state representatives were not menstruators. So, and also, as we know, there's a stigma about talking about menstruation. And so there was a period where even though it was really unfair and for me enraging, it was more understandable. At this point, with so much press and with the Michigan legislature having considered this since 2016, it's not accidental anymore. It just seems that there is just a problem in dealing with an issue that does affect the budget. And the governor has really tried to remedy that this session by including a line item in her budget to account for the removal of the tax. So, you know, we hope that also litigation, you know, the threat of litigation, the fact that we're asking for a refund of 4 years of taxes is really sending a message to other states, the 29 other states that do this, that have this tax, that, you know, you have to deal with this problem now. It's no longer acceptable that, you know, something that might have been overlooked is now not dealt with. And especially, like we've said, you know, during a time that has really impacted women like no other in recent years.
Laura, what else is Period Equity working on to try to end this at an is it in the cards to try to tackle it from a national level?
Well, you know, the problem is we've seen a lot of movement internationally toward things that Period Equity is supporting and working on, and those are mostly in three buckets. The tampon tax, and when we started, there were 40 states. We're down to 30. Access to products through legislation that, you know, mandates free products, and they're doing this now in New Zealand and other countries around the world. And also we focus on making sure these products are as safe as possible for the people who use them and environmentally sustainable. But state sales taxes are handled at the state level. So the federal government has actually stepped up in a way that has not gotten enough attention very recently in last March with the CARES Act, the first CARES Act, because it finally reclassified menstrual products as qualified medical expenses, meaning that can be purchased now with pre-tax dollars by employee health savings and flexible spending accounts. So the federal government, I'd say, is starting to do what it can. And it's now up to the states to deal with the sales tax. But there is actually a bill that will be, I think, introduced this month again by led by New York State Representative Grace Meng. It's called the Menstrual Equity for All Act. And it's a federal omnibus bill that has been introduced several times in the House that really is trying to use all levers of federal law and policy to address period poverty and menstrual equity issues. But, you know, the states can pass laws to provide free products, and Michigan really, after it removes the tampon tax, should really step up to make sure everyone in school has these products so they don't miss school, because that's a very big issue. And there have been recent studies about how this harms women, because they have unequal access to education, which, you know, is under Title IX is something they're entitled to. So, you know, the states can do a lot. And as mentioned, you know, many of them have. We have five states that have mandated that pads and tampons be provided in schools, and 13 states passed laws to require them in prisons and jails and shelters. So there are a lot of next steps. So one step at a time.
Laura Strausfeld is the co-founder of Period Equity. She's also co-counsel on the Michigan lawsuit. I've also been talking with Claire Pfeiffer, one of the three plaintiffs in Michigan's civil suit. She's a volunteer with I Support the Girls Detroit. Clara, Laura, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for making some time for us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by the dynamic team of Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye now.